From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 284, recorded live Wednesday, September 14th, 2011. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Nick Ganju about building his business, ZocDoc.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. The startup series continues. Today, we've got Nick Ganju, founder and CTO of ZocDoc. How are you, sir?
I'm great. How's it going over there?
Very, very well. I hear a little crowd noise behind you. What event are you at?
I'm actually recruiting here at the Stanford Alumni Career Fair here in Palo Alto.
Very cool. So are you guys based in the Bay Area?
No, we're actually based in New York City. But we're very obsessive about our hiring, and so we flew all the way out here to do this recruiting event.
Very cool, very cool. So what's the elevator pitch? What does your company do?
Yeah, so it's basically a website where you can come and search for doctors. You can read reviews. You can search by your insurance and, more importantly, your insurance plan. And then you can book the doctors right online, similarly to the way you would book in a reservation on an OpenTable.
Okay, so how do people do this now? I think I usually just search for, pediatrician, Portland, Oregon, and then I look around for, I kind of stumble around looking for reviews, and I ask friends if they think the guy's a good guy or not.
Yeah, it's interesting. As our SEO gets better and better, as you Google those kind of things, you'll see our pages showing up. But basically, it would still be hard if you did it that way to filter by your insurance plan. And, at ZocDoc, all the different doctors are aggregated one place in the same format. So there's all the reviews. You can see where they all went to medical school, any papers they've published, and of course some high quality photos of them in their office. So, I think it's just a much better destination site to make a decision about which doctor you want to see.
And do the doctors come to you and fill out these things? Is it like LinkedIn for doctors? Are they, how restaurants go into Google Places and they put themselves in there and they claim their space? How much of it's curated? How much of it is the doctor coming to you?
The doctors actually, so the business model is that the doctors pay us to be on the network. So they pay us a flat fee, flat monthly fee. And then we send them new patients. So that's the basic value proposition to the doctors. So they basically come and sign up with us, and they fill out their own profiles and put their own schedules, make their own schedules available there.
So then you make money from the doctor and then also during the referral process?
The doctors pay us a flat fee. It's not per referral.
So
they just pay us a flat monthly fee. And it's completely free for patients like yourself to, if you were searching for pediatricians. And the most important thing is you can see all the times and you can book online so you know if they're free tomorrow or you can find one that's free, during evening hours, et cetera.
I see. So that's where it gets interesting. So it's one thing to be a dating service for doctors where you you hook me up with a doctor and then our relationship is over, but you set a flat monthly fee. What's more interesting is that you are effectively their front end. You're their appointment scheduler, and the doctor, I assume, has some package running in their office, and then they synchronize with your system to make sure that the times are available and that booking of appointments can actually happen?
That's exactly right. So we integrate to many of the practice management systems that doctors use today, so we have this this automated synchronized system so that their availability is correct in real time on our website.
What kind of systems are those? What are these doctors running? Are these things all running Clipper and DOS prompt, or what do practice management systems look like?
Yeah, it's interesting that you asked that. I mean, most a lot of the practice management systems are very archaic. To be fair, a lot of them have upgraded their systems quite a bit, but a lot of doctors don't upgrade when the vendors put out new systems. So a lot of these doctors are on old systems. And some of them are green screen, et cetera. And part of our engineering efforts at ZocDoc is to integrate to things that aren't built, in a web 2.0 world or, you know, there's applications that store things in, you know, in old binary file formats and stuff. Mm-hmm. And we go in and we figure out those formats and we create integrations to those systems.
So that suddenly, from my perspective, makes the engineering problem that you're solving like much harder. Like I immediately thought to myself, oh, it's match.com for doctors and patients. The doctors pay, you know, it's like the club, right? The ladies get in free, the men pay. And right. except suddenly the ongoing relationship becomes one of very complicated. You're plugging in different APIs all into your aggregate API, but not all of those practice management systems are in the cloud. Probably a good number of them aren't. They're packages locally that never expected to ever give their scheduling data out. Do the doctors have to say, oh, I've got HanselDoc installed and it runs in Clipper. I need to go and install a Windows service from ZocDoc to go and suck that flat file out and send it up. And are you suddenly writing software like that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're, you know, I mean, you know, some of my guys are sitting there staring at the matrix. They're staring at hex files, you know, in a hex editor and unwinding where that data is stored. So it's quite a challenging problem.
Yeah.
And I mean, but it's also a good thing, right? I mean, if every practice management system had some super clean API, then we wouldn't really have a business, right? This is the hard thing that we're doing that makes us sort of, you know, hopefully unique in this industry.
Yeah, and that's where the value comes in. I mean, that's where a doctor is going to say, well, why am I paying you money? It's like, well, hey, I just got HanselDoc to talk to our backend services, and you just turned into a Web 2.0 doctor. You should be happy about that, Doc.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, our web interface is more modern and is more, you know, user-friendly than some of these old archaic systems. And so some of these doctors are actually, once we get the integration working, they're actually using our interface instead of the own interface that came with the system.
Which is actually a little scary. Can they actually replace their practice management system, or at least their appointment scheduler, with your stuff? Because I would think it's one thing to write an agent in a custom thing that sucks out some B-tree file from an old system and sends it up in a read-only fashion, but to actually poke into a system, even a multi-user one that's not expecting someone to be talking to it. You know, how is your software doing the synchronization? Is that nightly? Or
That's a
hairy engineering problem, I would think.
It's absolutely a hairy engineering problem. And no, it's not nightly. It's real-time integration with these doctor's offices. I mean, basically, it's not a trivial engineering problem. And this is why we're here at Stanford, you know, career fair, trying to get strong guys to come in and help us with this.
Yeah, and you guys are hiring, and it sounds like you have a high bar, but certainly people could contact you if they think that they're hardcore enough to stare at the matrix. What is your stack like? What does your system run?
Sure. So it's a purist's Microsoft stack, you could say. It's a SQL Server running on Windows Server 2008 and IIS and ASP.NET, but we're moving, you know, we're moving towards MVC3, mm-hmm. and it's all C#.
Are you doing web forms now, or are you doing a different earlier version of MVC?
It's not web forms in the sense that we use the, you know, the Microsoft, you know, ASP colon form, that kind of stuff, right? It's sort mm-hmm. of, you know, if you look at our sort of search results page, it's way too, you know, complex for that. It's very, you know, Ajaxical and very mm-hmm. Sort of real-time updating. And so we've written a lot of custom, you know, it's a lot of percent equals, right? It's a lot of open bracket percent equals mm-hmm. kind of custom stuff to make the Ajax really look fun and animated and et cetera.
I see. So it was a control thing. It sounds like you guys need control stuff. I mean, you're editing, you're looking at hex type dumps and you're writing little services on the one side, and then you really wanted serious down to the byte control on the client, on the as far as the angle brackets that came out the wire.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've even done steps to to minimize cookies and minimize the upload of cookies, and you know, we want to make sure an HTTP GET request fits in one packet, right? And so, you know, these are the levels of tunings that we're doing because of the amount of traffic that we serve, and so mm-hmm. We really kind of hand fine-tune the optimization of the stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, people know that I work for Microsoft, although the podcast is mine and Carl Franklin. So while I do have Microsoft people and Microsoft technologists on the show, a lot. You know, I try to keep it real. And it's interesting to me that you're a mature startup. You're a couple of years into it now. Is that right?
Yeah, we started in 2007.
And, but you know, you're still not giant, right? Would you say it's taken off and you've succeeded? Is it's finished, or would you still call yourself where are you in the maturity of startups?
I guess. Sure. You know, I would say we're in the growth phase right now. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the business model works. You know, the doctors like it. They get new patients. Patients, of course, love it because they mm-hmm. can, you know, search by any criteria, whether, you know, doctors available in the evening or whether they take some obscure insurance plan, mm-hmm. Et cetera. And so, you know, the business model works, and I think we're just trying to scale it right now. So we're just trying to, launch we're launching city after city in the U.S. and just trying to get scale right now.
Okay. So back to my point about working for Microsoft, I'm not trying to be a Microsoft apologist. I'm trying to be, like I say, keep it real, but I don't usually think of people who go to startups that go to Stanford, jobs fairs as being Microsoft. You don't think of Microsoft being in the Bay Area. And frankly, let's be frank, I don't see a lot of young startups using Microsoft products until recently with this BizSpark thing where they give a lot of stuff away for free. Has that been a challenge for you? What's your opinion of like Microsoft as it relates to the startup community?
I mean, for sure it's been a challenge, you know, for you guys to get some traction in the startup community. You know, I think part of it is, you know, of course, before BizSpark, you know, if it's two guys in a room with no budget, you know, they didn't have the money to shell out for a SQL Server Enterprise and et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that was reason one. I think reason two is kind of this dogmatic, you know, Microsoft, those empire guys.
Those big evil people.
Yeah. I'm glad you said it because I didn't want to say it.
No,
you know, and so part of it's dogmatic from that point of view. And of course, that's not, you know, that's never a good decision. That's never a good criteria to, you know, to base any decision. You know, I sort of didn't feel that way, and I wanted to make an objective evaluation of different technologies when we started in 2007. And, you know, I came from a Java background. And of course, C# is very similar to Java. Has quite a few improvements, of course. I'm probably getting in trouble just for saying that, but we love C#, and I think the static nature of C# and Java, and that family of languages that is, you know, sort of statically bound. I think that stuff will really save you when you do get to scale. So we're at 20 engineers now. We're looking to get to 40 very quickly. Mm-hmm. And the static nature of it allows you to do these compile time checks, and even, you know, the static code analysis tools such as FXCOP and ndepend really allow us to ensure code quality at a highly automated level, which is really kind of a savior when you're scaling your engineering team this quickly. And I think that these dynamic languages, Python, Ruby, and now, of course, JavaScript with Node. I think that if you're not really, really careful, you can get to a lot of trouble when you get into a large code base and have multiple, lots of developers all crowded around the same code base doing things really quickly. I think the dynamic nature of that can kind of lead to spaghetti, unless you're very, very disciplined about it.
Well, I've said before, though, pushing back a little bit, that I felt that compilation was just the first unit test. And it's almost like a spell check, right? It doesn't tell you if this is grammatically correct or semantically correct or correct at all, but it does tell you that it's spelled right. Do you think that, are you thinking about things in terms of the compiler, or are you thinking more in, like you mentioned, ndepend and static code analysis? Are you using things like code contracts? Because I think it is true that compilation is really simply a syntactic unit check. But if you really start being introspective and looking at the code, whether it be with aspect-oriented different things or code contracts, you can learn a lot about what's going on, and you can basically save yourself, put in a safety net. Do you have that level of formalization in your system?
Let me give you an example. So, we wrote our own SQL-level interface to interface with SQL Server. So
a micro ORM?
Yeah, a micro ORM, and we can get into how that works in a minute, but basically, we've replaced SQL command with our own, Zocdoc SQL command, which basically, it's not rocket science. It just owns a SQL command inside it, and it passes all the calls along. But But since it, you know, it intercepts those calls, we can add things there, like, you know, you can measure how many SQL commands you're executing per second or per minute, or, you know, you can see which ones are hogging SQL Server, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, that's a library that's really useful. Now, of course, that doesn't stop someone from still saying, you know, new SQL connection and new SQL command in our code base. But if you have FXCOP, you can just say, you know, at the build time in the continuous integration process, you say, you know, you can't call the constructor of SQL command. And so that way, if an engineer forgets, or it's a new engineer who's, you know, somehow didn't get that guideline, the second they write one of those, it instantly says, no, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. You should be writing Zocdoc SQL command instead of, you know, the Microsoft SQL command. And so you enforce that level of you know, code accuracy right there, so that nobody can write a SQL command and sort of bypass the system that we've set up to do the self-profiling.
Hi, this is Scott coming to you from another place in time. Are you using agile practices to manage your software development? There's lots of tools in the market that manage the steps of a project, but most of them focus on individual roles. Get ready for a solution that caters for the success of the whole team. The guys at Telerik introduced TeamPulse. It's an agile project management tool that'll help you gather ideas, estimate, plan, track progress in a common workspace. Finally, companies, regardless of their size, can use a lightweight and convenient tool that makes all the stakeholders work as a united team, even if they're in different countries. By combining intuitive user interface and the power of Silverlight, TeamPulse removes the roadblocks that you typically face in applying Agile in an effective manner. No more lost data, no disparate systems, no lack of critical analytics regarding the health and velocity of your project. See for yourself. Get a free copy for 5 users and 1 project at Telerik.com/TeamPulse. And please do thank Telerik for supporting Hansel Minutes on their Facebook fan page, facebook.com/TELERIK, Telerik. We do appreciate it. There wouldn't be a Hansel Minutes if there wasn't Telerik helping us. I've always thought that FXCOP was one of those things that wasn't used enough, but I felt a little bit like it was too hard to write a rule. And maybe it was just my own laziness, but I just felt like there'd be this utopia where I would have like 30 or 40 good solid FXCOP rules that would just kind of just tighten the screws a little bit and make things a little tidier. How many do you have? And did you find it difficult to build up a library of FXCOP rules?
Yeah, you know, there's a balance. I think there's a video somewhere where, you know, someone has written, someone works somewhere where they have, you know, 100 FXCOP rules, and they write something that's 3 lines, and then it says, you know, you haven't initialized this variable, and you haven't done this thing, and it complains so much that by the time they're finished, you know, making all the FX rules, FXCOP rules happy, the thing has swelled to like 25 lines from 3 lines. And so you have to find, this balance of enforcing what you want, but not making the rules so arduous or overreaching that, you know, it's just this giant pain just to get things to work with FXCOP. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting balance, and it's something that, you know, that we tune every day. But, you know, to just give you, you know, the short answer is that most of our FXCOP rules are really, really simple like that. We've, you know, we just sort of, you know, we don't want anyone using SQL command, so we have our Zocdoc command, and we don't, you know, we've written our own, in the MVC world, we've written our own Zocdoc controller that, you know, overrides or inherits from the regular controller, and we don't want anyone to use the regular controller. You know, we don't want anyone to extend the regular controller. We want them all to extend the Zocdoc controller. So, you know, that's another rule. You can't extend controller. You have to extend Zocdoc controller. And so, you know, it's just those kind of rules that allow us to have that consistency. And then, of course, the Zocdoc controller can do the same. It's analogous to the Zocdoc SQL command in that it can, you know, it'll do its own profiling and seeing, you know, if one page is getting hit exceptionally hard, et cetera.
So it sounds like, though, you have a very specific business model, but you're describing a few things like a standard Zocdoc-specific controller or Zocdoc-specific SQL connection that are solving problems that are not specific to patients and doctors, which I think seems to be a startup thing. I don't know if it's a young person thing or a startup thing, but the idea of, well, we're going to start a startup and it's going to marry doctors and patients, but first we need a logging component. And then from there, like, you know, the not invented here, happens. Did you see that happen as a startup? And is that part of the startup process or part of the .NET ecosystem that caused that?
I think you're completely right. You know, these problems are not specific to us. We have, the micro ORM and the ZocDoc controller, like you said, are absolutely things that would be useful to more than just us, and they are sort of generic tools. We do want to open source these kind of things, and I think we will as soon as we get the bandwidth to kind of just clean them up and make them presentable to the community. Certainly we're not philosophically opposed to open sourcing our generic things. And you're right. It's interesting that Stack Overflow is down the street from us in New York City, and reading through their blogs, I found that we were inventing some of these generic things in parallel to them. And so, I ran into Joel at one of these startup-y convention type things, and I told him, I was like, hey, look, we're doing some of the same things here, and then I had a long conversation with Mark Gravel about mm-hmm. The micro ORM that they've built, and they've built this Dapper micro ORM, which was almost identical to the one that we came up with independently, as well as the mini profiler that they wrote. And we came up with the same thing independently. And so, a lot of these tools should be used by more companies. And I'm not sure why, 2010 and 2011 that we have to invent these things.
Do you think it's specific to .NET? Or do you think it's just startup stuff? The reason I want to write my own thing. I'm trying to get my head around that I talk to Ruby guys and they'll say, oh, well, we did this, we did that, and this is best practice, but, we didn't feel there was anything in the universe that would meet our needs. And then they go off and they write something from scratch. It doesn't seem to me to be specific to .NET. I mean, I know that everybody, though, wants to blaze a new trail, even on old things. There's a story that I've told before about how I was working in finance, and we were doing online retail banking, which is extremely specific. And one of the young men wanted to create a calendar drop-down control. And he's like, I'm going to spend the next 2 days making the world's greatest drop-down control. And I just had to remind him, we're not a component vendor. There's component vendors that'll do that. And here's one for $400. So let's say you're valued at $100 an hour. You have exactly 4 hours to write the world's greatest one. Otherwise, I'm just going to buy it. Keeping focused on the business as something that you as a CTO need to do. How do you find that balance? And do you think it's specific to .NET?
I think that, what you're saying is absolutely right. And, we shouldn't be building things that we can buy or that are, open sourced. One of my friends, David Padbury, who's quite a .NET expert here in New York, made an interesting observation, which was, that Stack Overflow and us, we're in the minority in terms of the market because, there's not a lot of companies that do get this volume of traffic. And so, a solution like Hibernate might work for them because they don't need to, have such fine-tuned control over the SQL. If it comes up with something that's a little bit inefficient, it's probably okay. And so this micro ORM thing really comes out of us needing to hand-tune our own SQL and not have have the risk that the ORM comes up with something inefficient. But for most companies, that's probably okay because they're not getting the millions of hits that Stack Overflow or us get. Mm-hmm. And so, perhaps there hasn't been such a huge market for this micro ORM that some company came up with a solution for it, and that's why we're inventing it. And the other thing is that like you said, there's just not a lot of startup-y, sort of high traffic, .NET websites in general. And so, so I guess there hasn't been a huge market need for a micro ORM.
Yeah, there are definitely a lot of big .NET sites. And as I move around the community and visit a lot of folks, I find that it's just that we haven't heard of them, right? There's a lot of big sites that are big enterprises that don't talk about stuff. I was at a very large local shoe company here in Portland whose name you would have heard of, and they were doing something in .NET, and they were saying, all right, we got to need to go do this very specific shoe thing, and let's talk about logging. And it got me wondering, is that a problem that Microsoft should solve? Is that a problem that open source has solved, and they should just go and use Log4Net, or they should go and use the logging blocks, the enterprise blocks from Microsoft? Or did .NET not come out of the box with enough something, you know. There's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation there where we might release something and find it wanting, and then people will just pull it out and use their own thing. Or we produce nothing at all, and then people don't use logging at all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can tell you that it's another good example because, you know, we wrote our own simple logging thing. And the reason is because if we use one of the, you know, one of the existing logging packages, you know, for example, we want to just count all our hits, right? And so if we use one of the basic logging packages, it would just be writing so many hits because it's just the nature of how much we get per second. And so, you know, we wrote a logging you know, again, it's simple. Like, it sort of falls under the rule that you said, like, you know, if your rate is $100 an hour, then, you know, you can spend 8 hours on this and you're probably still, you know, okay. Mm-hmm. So it's that level of, you know, of simplicity. But it has to aggregate before it writes anything, right? Because otherwise, if it was writing every time we asked it to log, it would just constantly be writing to disk, and you know the files would get huge, and they would get fragmented, and then you know the disk would start thrashing, and etc. And so this thing aggregates before it writes anything to disk, and right, so it'll say, you know, it won't write every time you got a hit on the homepage, right? It'll count the number of hits you get on the homepage, and then write that once a minute or etc. And so you know, rather than try to figure out how to get that to happen in one of the existing logging frameworks, it, you know, it was only a few hours of our time to get that to work in a simple logging system.
Someone mentioned a term to me recently I thought was really interesting, and they called it decision fatigue. And they said that one of the things that catches programmers by surprise, especially as they kind of get older or they get under the gun, get pressure put upon them, is that the actual fatigue of having to make a decision. So like in your example, we could go and we know exactly what the problem is. We know exactly how to solve it. We could go and do all of the analysis and the work and perhaps the legal legwork to figure out if we can use this or that or the other thing. Or we could go and do a big procurement thing. It's funny to go and put together the $500 one would need to purchase a piece of software, not to mention the actual analysis of whether it's the correct software, is a huge amount of effort to get $500 to go and buy a piece of software. But a developer can burn 5 hours by taking a really long lunch.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting observation. You know, we don't, you know, we're not at that size yet where, you know, we need to sort of have, you know, procurement. If something costs $500, I'll just buy it on my credit card, on my corporate credit card, and we won't go through a giant decision process there. So hopefully we never get into the situation where we're filling out procurement request forms and things.
Well, somewhere around 100 employees, I think that's going to happen to you. There's nothing you're going to be able to do about it.
You know, we should talk again in a few months, and I'll let you know how it's turned out. But yeah. Certainly evaluating, you know, all the logging systems and picking one would be, you know, even if they're all free, it's a few hours, you know, it's at least a few hours by itself, right? Mm-hmm. And so, to also just build it yourself in a few hours, something that, you know, will just work, is not outlandish when, you know, of course, you know, there's exceptions to it, right? Like, we're not going to write our own JSON serializer because that would not be a 4-hour project, right? That would be a big project. And so, you know, you have to make that decision about, you know, whether it's, it is in fact a few hour project.
Is that the litmus test? How many hours it'll take to go and do this thing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you think about the JSON serializer, right? There's one that works already, and it does what we need. It does, you know, it does it at the speed we need it, at the scale we need it. Mm-hmm. And to write one yourself would actually be fairly complicated because of, you know, if you start thinking about object graphs and you know, you have to like recursively follow, you know, the object graph, but then, you know, a child object could point to its parent also. So you have to not like go back up the tree, and, you know, it can get quite complicated quite quick. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in that situation, you know, we're not going to write our own JSON serializer you know, because it's not, you know, a few hour project. And so, you know, you have to make that, you know, you have to make that judgment call. You know, hopefully we're evaluating properly and making the right calls there.
It definitely sounds like a lot of challenge. And how big are you guys now after 3 or 4 years?
Yeah. So, you know, we just, did our Series C, you know, we raised a $50 million round from DST.
You're gonna have to back up and remember that not only do a lot of our listeners not know the startup world, but they're not gonna know those acronyms. So what's a Series C? What's DST? And congratulations on $50 million.
Thanks. Sorry. Yeah. Sometimes I get so caught up in our own startup world. Series C means it's our third round of funding. Mm-hmm. We took an investment of $50 million from a company called, you know, from an investor called DST. Mm-hmm. And DST is, you know, they're invested in Facebook and Twitter, Airbnb and a couple of, you know, sort of other high profile, websites. So we're very excited to have them as a partner, and we're moving forward with them. In terms of headcount, you know, we're about 150, probably a little bit more. That was as of last month. Mm-hmm. And about 20 engineers. But like I said, we're trying to get to 40 very, very quickly here, and then 80 after that. So there's a lot of, you know, interesting engineering challenges here, and so we're trying to grow that team very quickly.
Wow, that's great. And how long did this take? I mean, what does the power curve look like? I mean, were you just like, it was you and a buddy in a garage, and now you're 150 people? How did that happen over the last 4 years?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, sometimes I get, you know, kind of vertigo when I think about it, but that's absolutely how it started. We started in 2007. You know, my co-founder was on an airplane, and his eardrum burst when they landed. And so he was in severe pain, severe ear pain, and could not find a doctor in New York City that would see him, an ear, nose, throat doctor. And he was like, this is ridiculous. There's got to be, you know, some ear, nose, throat doctor in Manhattan that has, you know, the availability to see me. And, but he couldn't find one. So he contacted me and said, you know, we should both quit our jobs and do this. So it was, and you know, we have a third co-founder who was a former, doctor. And so it was just the three of us in a room for, you know, for almost a year. We did our first round of funding in late 2008, and then it kind of took off from there.
That's such fun. So much fun. I did that for a while. I did that. How many, I'm trying to think how many internet bubbles ago, you know, like 94, 95, 800.com, gear.com.
Yeah.
You know, we just had a good time. It was just like pre-Amazon, right? When you could do anything, you know, like when all you needed to do a startup was a domain name, and all you need now is a domain name without a vowel, you know, so many things have changed.
Yeah. That's right. I'm actually, you know, I was actually around for that first, iteration as well. I was, mm-hmm. You know, I was in the Bay Area in, 99, and I did a couple startups that, didn't do that great, but, yeah. But I was, you know, I remember those heady times as well.
Yeah. It's so fun. I think I got like, I had a couple of, investments in a couple of early startups. I think like the biggest startup that I did was like, I made $2,500 on mail.com, you know, like, you know, mail.com went big, and Git went big was like, you know, a couple of grand for the contractors. So it's like, good job.
Yeah. I never saw any big exits out of those either. Hopefully this is the one. I think ZocDoc is, you know, it's doing well. So.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, great to know that you're hiring, and that folks can check you out at ZocDoc. And, I assume they can also find you on Twitter. Are you guys up there?
Yeah, absolutely. We're just, you know, at ZocDoc. We're hiring. It's just sort of a shameless plug, but if you feel like you're out there and you're a strong .NET and C# engineer, then get in touch with us.
Absolutely brilliant. Thanks so much, Nick, for chatting with me today. This has been, and I'll see you again next week.